And once again, we say greetings to each and every one of you. Akwaba. Welcome. Welcome to another round of Culturally Conscious Communications here on the LIB Radio, LIB TV, and LivingInBlack.com networks. My name is Kidi Owadu, a.k.a. The Conscious Rasta. Weekday mornings, we get together with you live from 8 a.m. here on the West Coast. That's 11 a.m. for our East Coast listeners, and that is 4 p.m. GMT and 7 p.m. East African time. We get together with you to deal with culture, consciousness, historical perspectives. We deal with entertainment, economics, education, health, labor, law, politics, religion, family, conflict, all areas of human interactivity and development. Today's date is Thursday, the 5th day of March, the year 2015 in the Western calendar. This corresponds to the year 6255 in the calendar of ancient Kemet, to which we have realigned our cultural clock. Welcome to the 7th millennium. You have found your family in a peaceful place here on LIB Radio, LIB TV, and LivingInBlack.com. Let me describe for you our second hour before we bring our first hour guests on. A second hour here on LIB Radio, as we do every week. We continue our weekly series called Mastering Monetization with Ankh Aku and the Conscious Rasta. Every week we talk about a spectrum of critical topics on entrepreneurship, business development, marketing techniques, and essentially wealth building. Today, this week's topic will be how to use direct response to drive results. Our first hour guest, I've had the wonderful pleasure of knowing him for a number of years, seeing him in action on a number of fronts. He is the author of the Dynamic book, which I hope everyone has in their catalog, Blackonomics, The Way to Psychological and Economic Freedom for African Americans. And he is also the frequent contributor to his blog at Blackonomics on a spectrum of issues related to economics. We have so much to cover with our guests today, so let us welcome without any further delay, joining us from, I believe, Metropolitan Cincinnati, or Double Sin City, as I used to call it, Baba Jim Klingman, Professor Klingman. Welcome today.
Thank you, Brother Kidi. Good to be with you once again.
It is absolutely a pleasure, to be with you, Baba Jim. How's life treating you over there in Cincinnati?
Well, I'm not in Cincinnati right now, and they have several inches of snow, so I'm glad I'm not there. I'm down in the south where it's real warm, about 65, 70 degrees.
That sounds like a great move for me. I was just going to ask you about those terrifying words called wind chill factor.
Right.
Baba Jim, it's always been a pleasure over the years to have known you, to be able to host your voice numerous times here on LIB Radio. I consider you to be not only a scholar, but a gentleman, and really one of the bright lights amongst our community, helping us all to get focused on those things that really matter. You recently wrote an essay. That essay was entitled Black Dollars Matter. There was a, can I read one paragraph from your essay as we bring in this dialogue today?
Sure.
You wrote, "The protest slogans relative to our latest struggle for justice and equity compel me to come up with a new phrase. The signs and t-shirts emblazoned with, I can't breathe, no justice, no peace, and the latest, Black Lives Matter, carry connotations related to action. I often wonder what the folks who wear the t-shirts and hold the signs are doing to back up the slogans thereon. More importantly, I wonder who makes the shirts and who sells them. With that in mind, my slogan for action, economic action, is Black Dollars Matter." Give us more background to your publication of that critical essay, Bob James.
Well, I've been watching all of the developments, Brother Kidi, around the country since August. I'll take it back that far when Michael Brown was killed. All the outrage, all the rancor, and all the things that took place since then with the other brothers who were killed as well. And I just had a thought when I saw the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Brooklyn Nets come out with their shirts that said, "I can't breathe." And my first thought was that these were the last words of a black man that we saw on TV be choked to death. And then I did a little more investigation about the shirts, and I found out that Jay-Z and LeBron James and a couple of other white guys, one of whom is so-called political voice for Russell Simmons, his name is Michael Skolnick, they got together at the on the idea that Jarrett Jack first came up with, he's a player on the Nets, to have these shirts that say, "I can't breathe." What struck me as appalling was that they went to a white company to get the shirts printed. And Jay-Z, I'm told, bought about 1,000 of them after the famous game where LeBron James played and the king and queen, they weren't the king, but, you know, the prince and all that were there. And I was just very outraged by it that we have a black man that the whole world saw die, and his last words were, "I can't breathe." And it reminded me of an article I wrote some time ago called "The Prophet of Protest." I wrote that right after Trayvon Martin was killed, and everybody went out and bought Skittles and iced tea when mm-hmm. they marched.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, how ridiculous is that, and how short-sighted are we as so-called black activists and black folks who are concerned about the brothers being killed to go out and enrich some white companies? And in this case of the "I Can't Breathe" shirts, the first batch were bought from a Canadian company that pays its workers in Haiti $6 a day
mm-hmm.
to make the shirts that multi-million dollar basketball players and Jay-Z and others were wearing with the words, "I can't breathe." So, you know, I guess to cut it short, I was just outraged by it, and this article came out of that after I looked into who made the shirts, who got paid for them, and all of that.
It brings up a number of different topics. One of the first that comes to my mind is, who's coming up with these tactics and strategies, and how quickly, what is the means that they're so quickly being dispersed throughout our population so that a large number of people are become engaging in tactics which actually probably will do very little, if anything at all, to mitigate the issues which really are a challenge.
You're right. You're right. And I'm glad you mentioned the word tactics. Just recently, every day I put on Facebook a quote, and 2 days ago I put this quote up. "Strategy without tactics is the slowest route to victory. Tactics without strategy is the noise before defeat."
Mm.
And that comes from The Art of War. And you hit the nail on the head. We do these things and we, you know, we march and we yell and scream, but it only lasts a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And we have no end game. We have no strategy around why we're doing what we're doing. And that is part of my, you know, that lends to my deep concern as well for us as a people in this country.
Yes. The other tactic that really kind of grated on my nerves, "hands up, don't shoot." Well, traditionally, that's a sign of defeat, of surrender.
That's right.
And
there
we're
you go.
Wondering
that's a good one.
If you, we should be encouraging our young people to surrender in the face of a spectrum of challenges which really ultimately are a challenge to their generational empowerment. Baba James, do we want our young people moving into the future with such a "hands up, don't shoot" defeatist mentality being embedded in their subconscious mind?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And it flies in the face. It's really a contradiction when we say, when we use this term, "hands up, don't shoot," and say that that's what Michael Brown was doing. Of course, there's a lot of controversy around that. But to say that, and he still got killed, you know, it's kind of a paradoxical way of expressing our outrage. So, no, I don't want our young people to grow up with that kind of mentality. But, Brother Keaty, we are so enamored by celebrity and by symbolism, rather than putting our efforts into substantive ways to change our situation, our economic situation especially, in this country, because I contend that if we change our economic situation by understanding that black dollars matter first and foremost in this country, we can change the other things that we often march and protest and complain about.
So, therefore, you've come to the conclusion that a better pathway for our larger population, as many as 45 million or more people of African ascent in the United States, especially for this class of young people, urban youth, predominance of which black males are subjected to a more intense degree of social, economic, political exclusion, your suggestion is that following the pathway illuminated by this terminology, black dollars matter, is the solution.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And you can look back in history. I've heard you talk about it before on your show. We can look back in history and see that that is, in fact, the way for us in this country to empower ourselves, first and foremost, to build a strong foundation, and then to be able to negotiate our complaints from a position of strength, not from a position of weakness, as you just talked about with the hands-up gesture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's take this systematically so that our listening audience can understand we're not just talking theoretically, conceptually. We're actually talking about deliberate strategy. First of all, can we get a good working definition of what you are terming black dollars, just so there's no conflict of concept here?
Yeah. I'm very simplistic, or at least I make every effort to be, in my writing, Brother Keedy. And I always tell people, I don't write to impress, I write to express. So my very simplistic working definition of black dollars, it's very simple, you know, obviously. All the dollars that black people have in this country, and we could expand that, of course, to the diaspora if, you know, if we want to look at the macro level of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we like to brag a lot about the black people now have $1.1 or $1.2 trillion every year in income.
Mm-hmm.
If we just look at that and say, okay, that's black dollars, and we don't understand the difference between income and wealth, then, you know, we're on the wrong track.
Good point that you make. As well, ultimately, isn't it true that black dollars are global dollars? You know, I don't know if I had this conversation with you recently, but when the recession hit the United States, many aspects of the American population, the workforce, the middle class, many aspects were hurt. And black people probably hurt as much or more so than any other group within this country. A company like Apple, by not restricting its business model only for the United States, was able to absorb this recession and shift its activities around the planet and not be devastated by this recession. So isn't it also part of our ongoing strategy to understand that ultimately black dollars are African dollars, are global dollars?
I am so glad you raised that. And to answer your question, yes. If you look at, and I wrote a piece a couple of years ago on black billionaires, and the first thing that comes to our mind is Oprah. Of course, Bob Johnson back then. And Bob Law once said in a meeting I was in, I think he said in the meeting that you came to in Cincinnati in 2006, he said, black people are happy just because Oprah is rich.
Mm.
We don't even think about all the billionaires on the continent.
That's right.
And when I wrote this piece last year, the year before, about black billionaires, that's exactly what I talked about. That we can't just overlook that or act like it doesn't exist. We're so hung up on Oprah, and hey, God bless her, but there are so many other black people in Africa who who are billionaires, and for us not to make some kind of reasonable connection back to not just them, but to the continent, period, as you do and others do around this country, is really short-sighted on our part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so very true. We're going to return to that subject in a little bit. For the people of African ascent in the United States, what is or how can the relative position of our labor market or labor potential, labor resources, how can this be developed within an economy that serves our own people? Do we have to wait until others offer us jobs?
Well, I'm going to quote that famous philosopher that we all are familiar with. His name is James Brown. He said, "Let's get together and get some land, raise our food like the man, save our money like the mob, put up a factory, and own the job." Again, a very simplistic instruction to us.
That is so
beautiful. What we should be doing with our own labor. Mm-hmm. We complain all the time that we built this country for free, they didn't pay us. But what are we doing to capture our own labor, to create our own jobs, so that we can hire our own people the way other groups have been doing in this country for years, and the way we used to do prior to integration, of course? My contention is that we must create our own jobs. We must not only start businesses, but grow those businesses to the point where we can offer our children jobs that we own. Right now, the vast majority of black businesses, the last economic census said we had 1,197,000 black businesses. Of that number, only 106,000 had employees.
Nah. Yes, I understand completely what you're talking about. On the subject of our labor potential, labor participation, many people have out of context who these young black males that are being excluded are. At least we should forget, back in the days of enslavement, black labor was highly valued in the development of what became the largest economy, the richest nation in the world. And it was these same young black males who are now being convinced to do hands up, don't shoot, whose bodies on the auction block, Baba, they drew the absolute highest price of all. They were the most valued in the labor market in the development of a great nation. Why is that no longer the case?
Because there was this epiphany, for lack of a better term, that we can make more money off young black males by incarcerating them rather than putting them to work. Work could lead to some form of empowerment, but prison is not going to do that. And we can make so much money off of them in this prison system. The other thing is that, you know, it gets back to education. That's another topic we could talk about.
Mm-hmm.
The lack thereof of real training from our own people going toward our young black males. But we're excluded from the labor market now, you know, like I said, because someone else owns it. They figured out a better way to use us, and we're not creating our own labor market by developing and growing our businesses.
Give us a few points which are crucial stages of action towards this massive expansion of black business and economic development that you have in mind.
Well, I've always been of the mindset, first of all, you know, you talked about, I'll get back to my original point, but you said that we have worked and created wealth, and then first thought came to my mind was Dr. Claude Anderson's book, Black Labor, White Wealth. Our labor created the wealth that white people enjoy. But my thought on what where we go from here is to look at industries and categories of products and services,
mm-hmm,
in which black people dominate. And we, if you look at the indices that are put out by marketing companies, you can see there are certain products and services that black people just, you know, index 50 to 100% more than our proportional population in this country. So we need to look at that and go after those kinds of industries and those kinds of categories of products and services that we spend billions of dollars on. Why shouldn't we spend those billions with our own companies? So if we would build and start, you know, companies in those particular targeted groups of businesses, then we could spend money with ourselves. The money we spend would go to another black company, and that company could grow, and you know how the cycle works. So that's where we should be looking to economically empower ourselves through business. We can't just continue to buy everything everybody else makes. We need to be, we need to move from the demand side of the economic equation over to the supply side a whole lot more than we are today, and control distribution of our products, control our own businesses to the extent if we're buying 90% of a product, or even 100% in the case of black hair care, then we should control that. But we let it slip, but it's not too late to get it back if we would really just work collectively toward that end.
This has been talked about for a number of years, Baba Jim Clingman. And again, for those who's tuning in, our guest today is Jim Clingman. He's the author of Blackonomics, and he has also written a very powerful essay, which is really the subject of our conversation today, Black Dollars Matter. I'm going to invite you, our listening audience, to also participate in the conversation. If you want to give a call and speak with Baba Jim Clingman, ask a question, you can do so at area code 646-716-9835. You can also Skype us at LIB Radio, as well as I will be looking through the discussion forum on livinginblack.com. I say greetings to brothers Kafra Hotab, Alpha Griot, and others that are tuned in there as well. Let's continue, Baba Jim. The hair care industry, personal care industry, the last time I checked, was generating some $9 billion in annual sales specifically from African American people, $9 billion, significant amount of money. If we consider that tactics for us to move more firmly into and control over this market have been advocated and pushed for, I've seen strategies and advocacy on that front for over two decades, yet we're still losing ground there. Is it wise to continue to push that as an issue, or should we move on to something else, or should we change tactics?
Well, I think we can do both or all three. I think that it's insulting to me, Brother Keedy, for black people to spend so much money on products that we can and used to make with folks who don't even use those products.
Hmm.
That's an insult to me. And I know, like you said, for two decades we've been talking about this, but I also know in 1985, 30 years ago, the American Health and Beauty AIDS Institute was started in Chicago by my cousin, Lafayette Jones. And there were 22 black hair care manufacturers. You remember the Proud Lady logo they used to put on the products to show black consumers that those products were in fact made by black folks. They were in the stores. So we did that. How can we not look back on the lessons before us and take advantage of those lessons by saying, first of all, we blew it, because those companies begin to be sold off to white companies. Just like this vice president of Revlon said in 87. He said 15 years from now, white people will own all these black companies. Folks got mad. Jesse came to Chicago and brought out the casket and threw all the Revlon products in there, so we're mad he shouldn't have said that. We want an apology, blah, blah, blah.
Mm.
15 years later, what Irving Botner said was true. Down goes Johnson Products because he wanted to collaborate and manufacture products for the power movement, which was started by the Nation of Islam. Down goes Proline, down goes Softsheen. They were sold to L'Oreal in 1998. I mean, it's just one after the other. And we look around, we only had Dudley, Luster Products, and Bronner Brothers. We blew it. And to me, you know, when I look back at that, I know that we can do this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can make hair grease. Your grandmother made hair grease,
yeah.
You know, made soap.
That's true.
So I think we can do it all. I don't know if we have the will to do it now, Katie, because we, like, again, we throw our hands up to the Koreans and say, okay, you got it. Nothing we can do about that. Let's move on to something else. I don't know where we stop, where we draw the line, but I know there should be a line that we're not willing to cross or to let others cross when it comes to our own economic future.
You know, Baba Jim, the reality of global economics trumps African-American
yes.
economics. That's just a
yes,
global
sir.
African economics, and then global economics, again, is even larger than that. And when we consider that many African nations look to people of African descent in the United States, so-called African Americans or American Africans, they look to us as a model. Hairstyles, fashion styles, music styles, art styles, cultural styles that are projected through mass media coming from our people in this country, when they hit places like Ghana and Kenya, Nigeria, South Africa, Uganda, they all want to be like us. So what was it that prevented the African American manufacturers of these personal care products from tapping into the fastest growing demographic on the planet, an African continent that now stands at 1 billion, expected to be 2 billion in 35 years, with Nigeria kind of leading it? The Nigerians, Baba Jim, you know, they're mimicking our behaviors. What stopped these manufacturers and producers from taking their products to the African continent?
Well, back in the 80s, when I worked in Chicago for a marketing firm, we did a lot of work with those black companies, and I do know that several of them went to Africa, and I don't know which countries, but did work to create distribution channels for their products in African countries.
Mm-hmm.
I can't recall the name of the one specific product that led the way or company that led the way. But there was an effort. I really can't speak to what happened to that, but there was an effort to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But as I look back, Brother Keedy, I don't think we were taking care of home the way we should have first to be able to go over to Africa and set up distribution channels for our products, our hair care products over there, because the base that we were trying to build back in the 80s had not been completely solidified to the point to where someone else couldn't come in and buy it or take it or put out products with African sounding names, making black consumers think that it's black owned, like African Pride.
Yes, sir.
And names like that, Dark and Lovely, those weren't black companies that made those products. So I think we should have formed a better partnership between black producers and black consumers. The Proud Lady was an excellent idea. But if you can't get your products, if you walk into a Walgreens and only see 1 foot of space on the shelf for black products, 2 jars or something, and you see 2 rows, 2 aisles, of all these white products,
mm-hmm.
you may not even have the opportunity to see the Proud Lady.
That's right.
Again, it gets back to owning the distribution rights
mm-hmm.
and not having to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in slotting allowances to get our products in somebody else's distribution channel who really doesn't want you as a competitor anyway.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, while the efforts were made, and I don't think we had a solid foundation here to be able to go over to the motherland and make the kind of progress that we wanted to make at that particular time.
Yeah. Well, is it working now?
You say, is it working now?
Yeah, I mean, you say that what we weren't strong enough to do it then. Are we strong enough to make that commitment now? Because
we're weaker
now. Because
than we were.
China, yeah. As you very well know, many people talk about, China is having a phenomenal success, not only across the African continent, but they're expanding rapidly into Europe. They're buying up much real estate in the United States. They're building a new Nicaragua canal that's going to dwarf the Panama Canal, as well as making trade deals all over the planet. But, you know, if we're talking about the mid-1970s, when China makes its first foray into Africa, China was considered to be kind of a third-world country, a poor country at that time. So
you're right. It's amazing how much, again, it gets back to us leaning on and celebrating symbolism rather than substance.
Mm.
Because, you know, you hear it say it all the time. Oh, if we were a nation, we would be the ninth largest, the 15th largest. That means nothing if we're not doing the things that need to be done on an economic level to move toward not only being the ninth or the 15th largest, but doing things that are commensurate with that size of an economy. And when I said we're weaker now, I meant that we're more dispersed now, we're more individualistic in our thinking now, and we don't have a lot of collective efforts to support one another. And to me, with all of the dollars that go through our pockets every year, again, I say that's an insult, and it's shameful that we are not working closer together, coming together to look at the opportunities not only here in this country, but in other countries.
Yeah. We do have a question that's come from our chat board at livinginblack.com. Kwame Pianki says, Baba Jim, do you think the mistake the Black Care Hair Products made was being overly dependent on white-owned businesses such as Walgreens and CVS to sell their products? Should they have focused more on hair salons, barbershops, and braiding salons?
Well, you know, Dudley and Bronner Brothers, they do that. Dudley based his whole business model on using some 30,000 distributors in individual beauty shops around the country. That was his sales force. Of course, Anthony Overton did it before him, and S.B. Fuller before him, and, you know, that's certainly a great business model. But right now, Dudley's suffering. And distribution is the key, Brother Keedy. You know that because you go back to Ken Bridges. You knew Ken Bridges and Al Wellington. And this is exactly why they started the Mata Network, because Ken Bridges used to work for Dick Gregory and his Bahamian Diet product, which the distribution channels in the big stores would not accept on their shelves because it competed too strongly with Slim Fast and those other products. Ken was the marketing director. He said, we need our own distribution channels. If you're dependent upon someone else selling your product that's going to compete with theirs, you're going to lose, especially if they control the point of distribution. We can have all the best products in the world, but if we don't control the distribution of those, or we have no channel through which they can be distributed, they're just a bunch of great products sitting in our basement or our garage somewhere. So the brothers, I mean, what he poses is right. We do need to control the distribution of products that we make. And the business models in black hair care industry back in the 80s included that. But, you know, Brother Keedy, quite honestly, I can't even imagine what it would be like for someone to come to me and say, well, I'll buy your company for $120 million.
Mm.
And that's what happened with SoftSheen. They sold it, Eric Gardner's son and daughter, they sold the company, but I can't say, you shouldn't have done that. You know what I mean?
I would have sold it and used the $100
million. Yeah, I mean, how did you turn that down?
Yeah. You know? Well, here's what I say. I would have sold it and used the $100 million to get on the front edge of breaking research, breaking technology. Excuse my bias, yeah. Baba Jim. I'm not even going to apologize for the statement. But from my perspective, $9 billion spent on personal care products is a waste of sovereign wealth development funds. When we look at what is happening in the world, that type of money, for about one-third of that money, in 2013, we could have purchased a supermarket chain by the name of Fresh and Easy, which was up for sale. The British-owned company Tesco had attempted to create a chain to compete with Trader Joe's and Whole Foods in this country, but they didn't really know how to market to Americans who were too irrational to use the chain. And it was a quality chain. It still does exist, but it was sold, and the ones who bought it kind of repurposed it, and this chain that bought it, led by Ron Burkle, they know how to rescue grocery store chains. When we talk about hair care products, Baba Jim, that's $9 billion a year, I think, according to 2013. But if we look at full-service supermarkets, African-Americans spend $80 billion a year.
Yes.
So why would we not take our monies and leveraging them up into bigger, bigger game?
You're exactly right. I mean, I can't argue with that at all. You're exactly right. And it gets back to us getting involved in owning areas of business in which we have a competitive advantage. We, you know, eating food, come on.
Mm-hmm.
Black people spend billions, like you said, on food every year.
We like
to
eat.
We can keep a grocery store open in New Orleans for 1 year.
That's right.
I mean, it's short-sighted. And you're right. $9 billion, far too much. Again, it gets back to symbolism over substance, though. We're buying somebody else's hair and increasing their wealth because we want it to look good. Booker T. Washington talked about that very aspect of black life when he was alive back in the early 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
How we just want to look good, and we'll buy all kinds of things. Look at the celebrities and the rappers and people who spend all this money on all these jewelry things, you know, around the neck and the rings and the diamonds and everything. It's out of whack. You know, our thinking is out of whack. But if you look deeply into what economics is all about, going back to Adam Smith and all that, you see that it's a psychological thing. It's a behavior. And people capitalize on our behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Our wants rather than our needs or told to us, you know, dictated to us, oh, you need this, you need this. So we go out and buy it. But it's really a want. And spending that much money on hair care, like you said, it's outrageous. But somebody out there is getting wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
On those dollars.
Yeah. Going forward, I want to return to the subject of black labor. Claude Anderson's book, again, you had mentioned Black Labor, White Wealth. I was always asking the question of course, much of my research kind of follows this, is why not have a follow-up book, Black Labor, Black Wealth? And we could look at the dawn of human civilization. Black labor created the first great civilization, first great empire on the planet, that of ancient Kemet.
Right.
Black labor created the wealthiest empire and emperor in world history, Mansa Musa of the Mali Empire. Black labor created wealth in South America, Central America, the Caribbean, North America. Black labor and black genius, black scientific genius, has been crucial almost at every step of the industrialization and high technology expansion of the Western Hemisphere. We seem to have an attitude amongst our own that black labor has no value, when others seem to always know when to pick it and pull it and use it and get themselves wealthy and then put it back on the shelf.
Well, I mean, again, no one can argue with what you just said. I mean, it's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that connection between black labor and black wealth, because if we study our history and familiarize ourselves with what we did prior to coming to these shores, I know we'd be more appreciative of who we are, and we would understand this whole notion of economic empowerment a lot better than we do today, and not concentrate solely on what we've done, the wealth we've created for white folks, which we have in no uncertain terms, but think about what we created for ourselves. And again, the lessons of our ancestors and our forebears are there for us to look at. If we would just not be so intellectually lazy about looking at it and learning from other people who know and teaching our children that, we'd be much better off if we would just take the bull by the horns and go on and do our own research and get in groups and talk about this, and if you don't know, find somebody who does, and build ourselves up. You know, Dr. Ed Robinson in Philadelphia used to teach all the time that not only do we need to have high self-esteem, we need to have high race esteem. I don't like this term race anymore, but we need to know who we are. We need to know what we've done, not since 1619, but many, many, many years prior to that. And maybe, just maybe, Brother Keady, with that kind of knowledge, and I'm working on a column right now talking about knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. We need to get to the wisdom stage where we apply what we know. You know, black people in general are information junkies. I heard a show the other day where this brother called in and he was telling the host, the guest, who was talking about, some history and everything, and then this other caller called in and he was telling the guest about other facets. I'm sitting here amazed that this guy knows a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, what do we do with what we know?
There you go. Yeah, so critical. I want to return to something you had mentioned a little bit earlier, talking about education. Oh, and there was one more question that Kwame had asked you. Are you familiar with the book Entrepreneurship and Self-Help Among Black Americans?
John Sibley Butler.
Oh, I trust that you're very familiar. What's in that book that people need to know?
I used to use that book in my class, my black entrepreneurship class that I taught at the University of Cincinnati for 12 years. John Sibley Butler, of course, I've had conversations with him, and he's done a lot of research on the power of black entrepreneurship, of entrepreneurship period, but especially black entrepreneurship, and just laid out a lot of instructions, a lot of information, a lot of data points on what we've done and how we've done it. And the book is just has a wealth of knowledge, a wealth of information that we can use to empower ourselves. It talks about history in this country, entrepreneurship among black folks in this country, and how we used it to empower ourselves. It talks about City of Durham, North Carolina, Atai District, talks about Black Wall Street in Tulsa, of course, and other cities that we developed and owned prior to the 1960s. So it's just an outstanding read. I think it should be in all of our libraries. We should, it's something we can definitely learn from when it comes to entrepreneurship as one of the ways for us to empower ourselves.
Okay, for those again listening, again, the title of the book, Entrepreneurship and Self-Help Among Black Americans. And that's by John Sibley Butler. Please, I'm going to get my copy, Baba James, on your recommendation.
He's a professor down at the University of Texas in Austin. The last time I talked to him, he was still there.
Great.
Along with Dr. Juliet E.K. Walker, who's also an excellent author when it comes to the history of black business in this country. And I contend that we need to study black business history. Mm-hmm. I am so sick and tired of, again, these corporations taking this money during February, mm-hmm. selling us our own history with an order of fries on the side.
Ooh.
And telling us that, well, so-and-so invented this, and Martin Luther King said, I have a dream. They never teach us or teach our children or sell us anything that has to do with the history of black business.
Oh, right. Especially when that black business becomes African business, becomes global business, and it still has our footprints, our fingerprints all over that development. I want to ask you, since you have this long experience in academics, what's up with the fact that in academic performance that black females so greatly are outperforming black males?
Well, I think a couple of things. One I already mentioned about the prison system and how that works, the court system and the injustices that we see. Of course, now we see a lot more black women going into that system as well and being incarcerated. But I guess I could give you an answer from a personal level. I haven't had both experiences of having a son and a daughter. I do have a daughter, and she did quite well in high school, elementary school, and she got scholarships to go to college, and she's about to graduate in May from Howard University.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations.
Summa cum laude with all A's and all of that.
Why are we not surprised?
Well, she did it, man. I give her all the credit. I mean, I tried to guide her, and I did. But, you know, she worked her behind off. It wasn't something that just came to her. She really worked hard on it. And I know other brothers and sisters around the country who've had similar experiences with their children. But, I the prison system, of course, is a big thing. And I believe that this whole notion of symbolism comes back into play. Because when you look at some of the commercials that are on TV, which our children are bombarded with. Black folks watch more TV than any other group in this country. And a lot of those commercials are geared toward the young men having a certain image. Of course, playing sports and drinking some pop. And that pop will make you a professional basketball player. Buying some shoes or having some shoes and it'll make you defy gravity. Hmm. A lot of those commercials and advertisements are geared toward the young men, and I think it throws a lot of them off when it comes to career direction and other things that they should be doing in their education process. It creates, in some cases, in our young men, this image that says I have to be the macho type. I have to show that I don't really care about this, and you know, education doesn't mean anything. And all those things, I think, come into play. Again, I haven't had the personal experience. I haven't a son, but I have worked with a lot of young people, and even the young men in my college classes, talk about that kind of thing. And it's another issue, I believe, that we must address, because more and more you're seeing our young women go through college. You go to any, especially HBCUs, and the women far outnumber the men. And what's going to happen, what is happening now, is that you see a lot of young women, you know, rising up in corporations and making excellent salaries. And then we complain when they run off and marry some white guy. And you see the black athletes and the entertainers, they marry white women. And
some of them now marrying some of those black athletes are now marrying white guys too.
Yeah, good point. Good point. But it that a lot of us have been seeking and continue to seek will only create what Albert Craig called us in back in the 60s. He said, if we continue down this path, we'll become a non-people. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, what we see with education and prison and, you know, the injustice and the killing and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it's leading us to if we continue to seek the standard of the very people that we complain about all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're still seeking that standard and trying to assimilate. And I think some of that speaks to the difference between the black females and males in terms of their academic performance.
I want you to respond directly to a statement I made a little bit earlier. Black economics is African economics, is global economics.
Well, it's absolutely true. Black, to me, and if you read, and I'm sure you've read it, Chancellor Williams' book, Destruction of Black Civilization, he has a section there where he talks about why and how we call ourselves black. And, you know, I use it interchangeably with African Americans black, but black, to me, is not just significant of black people in this country. It's black people everywhere. And in my very first book on economic empowerment, I have a section called Reconnecting, and I was talking, and this was written back in 1995 or 6, and I was talking about the need for us to connect, reconnect with our brothers and sisters on the continent and other places, in Bahia, down in Brazil, and other, in the islands.
In Cuba, look at the new door that's opened up to Cuba.
Right.
And
that's
don't
right.
we remember how fond of blacks in America was the still living former president, Fidel Castro? The door is now open. Baba Jim, as I look across the community, I have seen not one pro-black group, organization, or whatever say, now that this door is opening to Cuba, here's a plan.
Right.
I'm the only one that actually has put forward a plan, and there's one particular group that I've contacted. I say, you are the ones to lead our initiatives, and there are several initiatives that we have in mind, which would relink our people in this country to the people of Cuba, because outside of our view, when Brazil spent nearly $1 billion on revamping the Mariel seaport on the south side of Cuba, that's opening up Cuba to a whole new level of economic engagement throughout the Caribbean, Central, and South America.
Hmm. Well, I've heard people talk about it, but if you have a plan and what you do, I don't know what I can do to help, but whatever I could do, I would help promote that, because that's an opportunity right at our doorstep.
Yeah.
And if you recall back in the 60s, I think Cuba had and probably still does, had an outstanding relationship with Angola.
Mm-hmm.
And before I knew everything I know now, what were they doing in Angola? You know, and helping them fight and all this kind of thing. But we have that relationship. And what we need is more than talk about it. We need a plan, and then we need to execute the plan. So, like I said, it's an opportunity right at our doorstep.
Right.
But I believe that black economics does include African economics, does include global economics. We're in a global society. That's an overused term, but we are.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we can't turn our back on it. We can't ignore it. Our children and grandchildren are going to have to deal with it in some form or fashion. They'll either be a victim of it, or they can take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we collectively work on economic issues and look at opportunities and execute plans like yours to reconnect, the better off we're going to be. So I believe that the statement is absolutely correct.
Mm-hmm.
Black economics is African economics, and African economics is global
mm-hmm.
economics. Again, it gets back to, look at all the wealth, not the income, the wealth among African people.
Mm-hmm.
And those billionaires I talked about earlier.
One more question I've got to get on the table. I hate that the hour has flown by so fast. hopefully we'll be able to get you on far more regularly, because your insights and the authenticity and authority that you bring to these topics, I think, is a valued treasure. At least it is for me. I'm hoping other people see it as well. But very important question. We see the news headlines today talking about the report finally coming out from the Justice Department that what happened in Ferguson was a spectrum of violations of the rights of these people. They won't call them human rights violations, even though I can guarantee you, Baba, I will be able to go to the Russian or Chinese press within a week and they will use the term human rights violations with regard to what's happening in Ferguson. So my question to you is, to what extent should black dependence on public sector support of our critical institutions be relied upon in an era where the government itself is so challenged by the integrity, by even seeing us as having human rights challenges in this country, as well as the federal government's out of money? They're undergoing austerity and now structural adjustment because they're so deeply in debt. So to what extent, Baba Jim Klingman, should we be relying upon government agencies to help us get out of this hole?
Well, we don't know by now that they're not coming to our rescue. I don't know when we're going to know it. We've been sitting back waiting on that. We think our politicians, especially our black politicians, are going to come and help us. They're not going to do it. We need to rely on ourselves. And with that in mind, I'm working, of course, with a good friend of yours. I've been on your show, Brother Hamafika Diuka, with a group we're calling the 1 Million Conscious Black Voters and Contributors, where we're looking to build up a cadre of 1 million people, black people, who are conscious enough to say, I'm not going to worry about what party I'm going to, I'll cast my vote for. I'll cast my vote for people who work in my own best interest. And we're also looking at a group of people in that million, conscious black folks, who will pool our resources and do the kinds of things that you and I have been talking about today with our own dollars, build up our own economic structure with our own dollars. And we contend that that critical mass is about a million conscious black folks who are willing to do what we lay out needs to be done. Yeah. And it's very simple. It's a very simple process. There are a lot of people out here trying to do a lot of different things, but at the end of the day, somebody has to write a check. Somebody's got to pay for it. We have the money to do that. If we would just pool those dollars and take care of our own business and leverage our votes against this political system that is not going to come and rescue us, but it would get a whole lot of attention if you had a million conscious black folks who say to these politicians and to these systems, we're not going to vote for you. We won't even participate in the whole process if there's nothing in it for us.
We're going to.
That's what the.
No, I'm finish sorry. Your sentence, then we're going to have to wrap the show. But
okay.
There's a caller that wants to get in. I'm going to see if I can give that caller a few seconds, but please finish your sentence.
Well, I just want to tell people to go to IamOneOfTheMillion.com and read all about it. IamOneOfTheMillion.com.
IamOneOfTheMillion.com. 404, my apologies for waiting so late, but you've got 20 seconds. You're on with Jim Klingman. Your name and where you're calling from.
Greetings, brother. It's Brother Tabakuti from Asarset City. Real quick, and then I'll listen to your response off the air. Okay, I heard you mention several great teachers of marketing, mass marketing and media. And I know you are that great teacher as well. And I was thinking, what instead of different marketing people writing different books, what if you all came together? You talked about a plan. What if you all came together and put forth one book that we could all look towards and say, if we stick on this strategy, we can deliver ourselves, and everyone starts looking at, aiming towards that strategy and the principles in that book, and I will listen to your response off the air.
Okay. Thanks, Trevor, for the call.
Thank you, bro. That's certainly something that I find intriguing, and it's possible. Of course, we could do it with the 1 million conscious black folks. We could do that. We have enough expertise, both intellectual expertise and financial power, to be able to pull that off. I have no problem with working with anyone and sharing information that I have that's going to uplift our people. So certainly that's something. If your brother wants to get in touch with me, go to blackonomics.com, call me, send me an email, and I'll talk to him more about it.
Again, that's Black, B-L-A-C-K, Onomics, just like it sounds, .com. You will find much more on Baba Jim Klingman, James Klingman, and hopefully our listening audience will get your book, will engage, will go to the website to mention, once again, that website for people to learn more about being one of a million.
IamOneOfTheMillion.com.
All right. IamOneOfTheMillion.com. And
yes,
I will go check that out as well. And hopefully, Baba Jim, I'll get strategies beyond voting for Democrats again. You know, I'm
right.
I have to take off my shoes when that's being proposed, because personally, that one kind of makes my toes curl.
Yes, I understand. That's where I am.
I look forward to all of our conversations. Will you be able to join us more frequently here on Alabama?
I'd love to. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you are so valuable, so experienced. Do stay tuned, everybody. We're going to be joined in the second hour with our regular Thursday programming, Mastering Monetization with Ankh Aku. We will be talking today's topic, and let me just put this on the table today. He always brings a great set of strategies. Today's topic, what we'll be talking about, is how to use direct response to drive results for your business and entrepreneurial expansion. So don't you even think about going to where you're tuned into your favorite. We aim to be your favorite. We are LIB Radio, LIB TV, and livinginblack.com. Music from Zap Mama. Don't you go nowhere. I'll be right back.
Mele mele nalandie Mboka kitoko polisio Zila zila mokombosio Azange mokilantum.